to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today is the president and CEO of the North Valley Community Foundation, a philanthropic foundation based in Chico, California. During Alexa Benson Valavanis's 9 years with the foundation, it has raised more than $40 million for local, national, and international charitable causes. She sits on numerous nonprofit boards, including her role as vice president of 3CORE, a local economic development agency, and One Media Projector per Trainer, a nonprofit dedicated to educating the world's underserved communities. She has now written a book about her fight to hold on to her faith without abandoning her heart. She calls her memoir, Sipping Tea with Buddha and Christ. Alexa Benson Valavanis, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I've never welcomed a guest this way, but I'm going to say, ni hao.
Ni hao, ma.
For those who don't know Mandarin Chinese, Alexa just replied in Mandarin Chinese. So you spent time in China, but let's go back before you get to China to how you came to live in Chico.
Well, my twin sister and I were actually recruited by Marianne Lazzarini to play basketball for the Chico State Wildcats in the 90s.
And you were living in California at the time, but you weren't born in California.
No, actually, I'm a Hoosier. I'm originally from Valparaiso, Indiana.
So it makes sense that you would love basketball.
Yeah, actually, we didn't know there were any other sports but basketball until we left the state. So yes, everybody in Indiana is sort of basketball crazy, including us.
So you mentioned your sister. You have a twin sister.
I do. I have a twin sister. I also have another set of identical twins in my family, sisters. But yeah, my twin and I were recruited to come to Chico State. And wow, I fell in love with this place. It's just a beautiful little spot in the world.
Well, in fact, you and your sister and a couple of other twins were written up in the Los Angeles Times when you were playing basketball.
Yeah.
Well, you know what surprised me, though, is for people who can't see you right now, you're not tall. Like you think of basketball players as being very tall.
That's right. Thank you for not saying short. But yes, in fact, I'm about 5'5". And so what we didn't have in height, we sort of made up in scrappiness and feistiness, we like to say.
So you have these talents in basketball, and you're being recruited from all across the nation, and you decided to go to Santa Barbara.
We sure did. You know, there was something, there's always been something about the ocean for me. I loved being near the ocean. And so naturally, when we were invited on these recruiting trips as young adults, I was very drawn to being somewhere near the ocean. It wasn't until just a few nights before we had pretty much committed to going that we received a phone call from Marianne Lazzarini, the head coach at Chico State, and she said, just come up for a short visit. Let us show you around this little town of Chico. Of course, I'd never even heard of Chico before, quite frankly.
Much less know where it was located.
Exactly. And so, you know, there was something very compelling about her and about her passion for the game that I was drawn to. So we came up on that visit, and the rest is history, really.
So her invitation was such a warm one that you were willing to give up the ocean to come to Chico.
I was, yes. At that time, you know, even basketball was more of a passion than being around that mighty ocean. So it seemed like worth the trip.
So you're living in Chico. You go to school here. And then let's go to the point where you are wondering, okay, shall I go to graduate school? What should I do? So I'd like you to read from your book this crossroads that you came to in your life at the young age of 25.
Sure. At 25, I'd come to my crossroad, the conflict between who I was and who I thought I was supposed to be in order to please God, in order to be accepted in the world, was destroying any chance of real happiness. After more than a decade of trying to guilt, shame, and hate myself into not being gay, what was left of me was in pieces. I was terrified of leaving Christianity behind, but something had to change. Either God could love me as I was, or I was meant to live without God's love. I needed to find out. The scale had finally tipped. I was more frightened of a life of endless suffering than death in hell. I kneeled beside my bed in Hill's house and asked for the umpteenth time for God's forgiveness. I couldn't remember a time when I wasn't sorry for who I was. I needed a new start. I hoped to find a place to worship God where his followers didn't reject me as I was. I'd go to Nova Scotia and call God by a different name. Certainly the creator of all things would not be offended by something as insignificant as semantics. Of course, if anyone could understand, it was God. So instead of explaining my decision, I just begged him to find me at the monastery.
This is Alexa Benson Valavanis. She's reading from her book, Sipping Tea with Buddha and Christ. And you mentioned in that section of your book, you said, after more than a decade of trying to guilt, shame, and hate myself into not being gay. You also say earlier in your book, you say, my childhood was happy before I realized I wasn't like everyone else.
That's right. For me, and this sort of correlates with our earlier conversation about basketball. For me, I just dove into what I was good at, and I focused all my time and energy on the things that allowed me to feel accepted and honored and loved by people in the world. And for both my twin and I, that seemed to come quite easily with sports and academics and things of that nature. So I pushed aside any of those early feelings I had of being different. And at some point, it just kind of bubbles up, you know, when you realize that you're not being honest. You're not telling the truth. You don't know it at first because you're lying to yourself, but at some point there's a moment when you say, I'm just not being honest with the people I love so much. And so my early approach was just to deny it, to fight it. I think it's an interesting thing to hear from people who aren't gay that some even think it's a choice, because if you're a gay person, or even anywhere in the community, you know it's not a choice. You inherently know it's not a choice because you're not choosing anything. You just wake up a certain way. And so that was that battle. And it was quite fierce. And I think that's part of what I wanted to share in the book, was what that's like for someone.
You know, speaking of what's in the book, what I was surprised wasn't in the book more was you have a twin sister. And I know a lot of twins are so close that I expected to hear more about your sister, your twin. But then I'm thinking, well, you probably want to respect her privacy. But was there a particular reason that she, or maybe it's because you were traveling at the time and you're just far away?
Actually, Alicia is my best friend. And so what I did with this book was, actually, quite frankly, at first it was just to get it out of me. Every time I sat down to write anything else, this is the book that arrived. So finally I said, fine, I'll write it. But I intentionally did not include stories, many stories from my childhood or with my family and friends, because it was a journey that I went through. And I wanted to share it from that perspective and not try and include the thoughts and feelings and experiences of everybody around me. It was hard enough to really dive into my own journey, let alone include others. So that was sort of intentional along the way, that I wanted the reader to know that I had a wonderful experience as a child, but the journey was not completely wonderful, and that was mine.
Well, at the point where I was mentioning that you were trying to make a decision about whether to go to graduate school or to move to Nova Scotia and dedicate my life to God. And for people who don't know, there is a monastery there in Nova Scotia. So you had decided, okay, that's what I'm going to do. And you're sitting in this house, you say in Hill's house, short for Hillary, friend of yours, sitting in her house, and this is the middle of the night practically. And what was that knock on the door?
A friend of hers had come to town. Actually, she'd just gotten off an airplane from a long travel from Shanghai, China. And here she was at the door. And I had literally moments beforehand decided to dedicate my life to God and basically abandon my sexuality and abandon the desire for human companionship and just dedicate my life to God. And here she wanders in, and she looks and feels like a traveler. If you've run into one, and I'm sure you are a traveler, you know there's, you know, thread on her wrist of bracelets and disheveled bag and just the look of a traveler. And it felt like a sign. It really did. It felt like a sign. Here I just kind of proclaimed to God I was going to go to Nova Scotia and abandon all the things. Actually, now I can say I love the most about being human, love and companionship and connection. And at the time, I thought that I wasn't allowed to have those things as a gay person. So here she's come in with a totally different experience in life that I instantly wanted.
Well, why don't you read what she tells you? She tells you, this is on page 15, she says you should move to China. Read that section in your book, Alexa.
You should move to China and work with my kindergartens. I think so, too, I replied instantly, as if I'd been waiting for her to ask me this question my entire life. Leanne seemed startled by the ease and certainty of my reaction, but she looked pleased. I decided over my second cup of black coffee to leave my graduate degree dangling on my fingertips and move as far away from my life in Chico, California as geographically possible. The destination was the electric and booming metropolis of Shanghai, China. God would be there. He'd been there for thousands of years. I would wait to work things out with him in Shanghai. Nova Scotia would have to wait. My new beginning was east, not north. I would begin again, anew in Asia.
This is Alexa Benson-Valavanis reading from her book, Sipping Tea with Buddha and Christ. So you've made the decision to go to Nova Scotia, become a nun, and suddenly, just with a knock on the door, everything changed. So you're in this quandary, and a friend of yours, a woman who's a little bit older, had told you, Alexa, religion and God are not the same thing. God is love. That's it.
That's right. And, you know, I think this sort of speaks to what happens when you're lost, what happens to you when you're wandering. And I talk about it a bit in the book, but everything does feel like a sign. It really does. It feels like, oh, it must be that way. It must be this way. happiness is right there at the edge of wherever you are. And it's pulling you towards it. And for me, that could have been a knock at the door, but it easily could have been when I woke up in the morning and walked down the street. It was just a longing and searching for something outside of myself. I had yet to learn that the happiness and contentment that I was seeking was inside. And so I dove on it. I mean, what was better than flip-flops and a traveler and an invitation to Shanghai, China? But yes, I think it does really speak to the confusion that I had, that little Alexa, the story I had about God really living within religion, and for me specifically raised a Christian in a really gentle Christian environment, but Christian nonetheless, I had associated God with religion. And it took years and years, and still today it takes a lot of prayer and contemplation and quiet to separate and to look at some of those stories that I had.
You know what? I had to laugh at myself when you talk about taking things as a sign. Oh, this must be a sign. So I read on one page about, you mentioned your Greek heritage, your last name in case people are wondering, Valavanis, Greek name. So I read that and then a couple of pages, and then I thought, oh, I'm trying to decide where to go on my next trip. Maybe I was thinking about Greece, and so I was thinking, oh, maybe that's a sign.
That's
I should go to Greece. And then a couple of pages later, you mentioned things taking as a sign. I thought, oh, I'm taking a little bit too far, I think. So you're getting ready to go to China. And I was very interested in the fact that you pulled down your copy of Thoreau and reread Walden. And my copy of Walden is so marked and highlighted. But you have this quote, and this is Thoreau saying, "The person with the fewest possessions was the freest." And you said you sold everything you owned, filled up 7 garbage bags full of your belongings, and took them to the thrift store here in Chico. And that's what I love about traveling with a backpack. Oh. You are so free.
You're so free. And again, for me at the time, a lot of those things were coming out of desperation and suffering. I just wanted to let go and let go and let go. And what I've learned now, really on the other side of that experience, I have profound happiness and contentment in my life now. I found that the journey of letting go is still at the crux of my experience, that the constant need to let go and let be, even though it felt very differently when I was stuffing everything in a garbage bag to give away, it's still that practice of letting go that I'm working on day in and day out.
Well, I think a lot of people who try to get away from their problems will recognize this sentence from your book. You get on this airplane, Airbus, for to go to China. And then later you realized, everything I'd been running from in America had boarded the Airbus with me.
Isn't that the truth? It's an interesting thing that we think somehow the reality and the experience is actually happening outside of us, that we don't connect that it's just all within us, and it's how we talk about it to ourselves and think about it, that that we're going to bring that wherever we go. And of course, it's very dramatic to be crossing the seas, and so it's very obvious when everything's still with you and you have none of your possessions and none of your friends and none of your storylines that are external. It's just very obvious.
Well, you say you you get to China. You had packed for a camping trip. You're off to China with your backpack. You said you packed for a camping trip, and it wasn't working out.
I don't know why I thought far away, probably because I had read these books and was quite nostalgic for just going with like a number two pencil in my heart and working it out with God. I just assumed I was going to a rustic place. You know, I really hadn't even looked at a map. I landed in this booming metropolis, you know. I had nothing with me. I went to this kindergarten where I assumed everybody would also be wayward travelers finding, you know, looking for their peace with God. And, of course, they had wonderful outfits and mascara and lip gloss and were totally put together and could go out for a nice dinner after work. And I was there with my, you know, probably cargo shorts or whatever I had pulled together from my drawers in Chico. So it was really an interesting experience.
Well, if it's any consolation, I was in China so many years ago that that's really the way it was. I mean, people dressed in somber colors. Women didn't wear makeup. You could hardly tell men from women. It was not like the China that you saw. So maybe you were still just thinking that's the way China would be when you got there.
Well, they call it the Paris of the East. And I thought, yeah, I would have packed at least a cocktail dress or something with me.
Well, you meet this man that the guy you take lessons from, Tai Chi, but he taught you much more than just Tai Chi. And I liked one of his quotes, because since I like to go on pilgrimages, you walk as a pilgrim. And he always said, if tea doesn't work, then walk.
That's right. I'd never heard anything like that. You know, the lessons that he shared with me about going in were brand new. This idea that you would just sit with a cup of tea. I'd read them in books by Pema Chodron, one of my most fantastic teachers, and even Thich Nhat Hanh and others. But I'd never had somebody look me in the eyes and say, take a walk. You know, if it doesn't feel good, take a walk. And so the lessons were just so profound. I was ready for them, and they were there waiting for me.
Well, you live in China for 5 months. You have these wonderful experiences with these little kindergartners. But you say your longing for the monastic lifestyle was still alive. So after 5 months in China, you found this temple that you go to. You said, I drank tea and talked to God there at that temple. I realized early on that the way of praying I had been taught was no longer comforting me. What did you discover about the way you were praying?
Lots and lots of noise. You know, it's when you start to quiet the outside of your experience that you realize it doesn't necessarily quiet the thoughts in your mind. And that what I would normally do is basically plug my prayer into whatever stream of consciousness was happening for me at the time. So if I was looking for something, I'd be praying about what I was seeking. If I was wanting something, I'd be praying of that. If I was worrying, oh, I'm a worrier. So it was usually not wanting or needing anything from God, but just giving God my worry. And what I started to notice was there were gaps in my thoughts. And in those moments, it seemed like the best time for God to join me. And so I just started to quiet even the thoughts.
Well, this quieting of the thoughts and this new way of praying and learning to trust. And I love this story in your book about this little boy who appeared when you needed help, because I have had this very experience. A couple of times came to mind right away when I was in France, and it wasn't a youngster, it was an old man. In a couple of cases, an old man appeared and just helped me find my way. But the difference, there's a big difference here, is at least I can speak French. You're in a country, you don't speak the language, you don't read, I mean, you've been studying Mandarin, but you go off on this trip by yourself. I just could not imagine this. And, well, anyway, you tell the story.
Sure. So here I am in Shanghai, and the things are starting to bubble up and over again. I'm noticing that a lot of that angst and unsettled feelings around my sexuality are beginning to show up again. I'm not truly being honest, and it's a whole new set of faces that this is happening with now. And so I thought, it's really time to get after it. You know, it was great to have the knock at the door and a new adventure, but I need to get really some resolution here with God. I mean, we need to work this out. I cannot go back and forth with this suffering. And so I thought, a pilgrimage, really. I thought, why don't I get on a train and head south? And I'd heard about this little island of Hainan, and I'll find my way there. And so I do. I sort of throw everything in a backpack that I can and get on a train and head south. And I land in a place called Guangzhou. And, of course, the Mandarin I had been studying was useless. I was mostly around Shanghainese dialect when I was in Shanghai. But here they're speaking a completely different dialect. And I am traveling around without the ability to even ask where a bathroom is or say, excuse me, which are the first two phrases I always learn.
You had pencil and paper to draw a picture. You had to draw a picture.
Well, what happens was I end up getting onto a bus because I don't see the ocean. I'm in Guangzhou, and this is where I'm supposed to take a boat to Hainan, and I can't find the water, so I certainly can't find the boat to get to the island. And so I get on a bus, and I jot down a picture of a boat to see if maybe that would work for the driver. He looks at me blankly and has absolutely no idea what I'm looking for. Well, I had seen earlier in the bus trip that a young boy had stepped onto the bus, maybe in our third or fourth stop. He sat in the front seat, and I thought, that's so odd. You know, I was afraid, so I was probably projecting most of that onto him, but I thought, why is he here alone, and who would let him do this, you know? And then he got immediately off the bus after that, and that was that. So finally, when I realize the bus driver can't take me to where I'm going, which is the ocean, I get off feeling defeated. It starts to rain. I sit down. A whole bunch of motorcycle taxis immediately approach me. And I think, I have to go somewhere. Here I am in a city I don't know, and I can't find the ocean, and how am I going to get where I'm going? So I start to load my large pack in the rain on one of the motorcycle taxis, and I feel a tug on my arm. And I look down, and it's that little boy that had been on the bus for that one stop. And he says in perfect English, not safe. And, of course, it was like being struck by lightning. I felt a jolt in my whole body, and I got off the motorcycle and just thought, this is it. I mean, I can't do this. This isn't working out. I'm not listening to the signs, and God doesn't care. And so I sort of sit down on the curb, and I'm just going to probably cry, you know, just let it go. It's not working. And the boy runs off, and the motorcycles leave, realizing they're not going to get any of my money. And a few minutes later, the boy returns in a taxi he's brought for me. And he does take me to a port, and I get into the details in the story. But it's for the next hours and many days that I wasn't even sure if he was real or an angel, because he saved me. Maybe not literally. Maybe I wasn't going to get in an accident, but he saved my soul in that minute for sure.
My guest is Alexa Benson Vallavanis. Her book is Sipping Tea with Buddha and Christ, and she has made this trip by herself down to this island in off the coast of China. And what were you going to do there?
Oh, well, I was going to find God for sure. I think the experience that I wanted to have in Hainan was just to find that quiet. I thought that I was going to get that when I went to this secluded place called China, and of course it wasn't at all that. It was this booming metropolis. So the idea still in my mind at that time was that I needed quiet on the outside. I still was looking to make the outside what I wanted it to be.
And you're turning 26. You have a birthday to celebrate and nobody to celebrate with.
That's right. So, you know, my entire life I shared that special day, my birthday, with my twin sister, and love doing that. And we still share that day as often as we can now. So I'm traveling around, and it occurs to me that I should spend it with somebody. And so I end up deciding the first person that smiles at me, now that I've found the way at the grace of this sweet angel to get to the island, that I was going to invite that first person that smiles at me to dinner. And I did. It happened to be a taxi driver. And I get into all the details in the book, but basically I asked the concierge to invite the taxi driver back later that evening.
Because the concierge spoke a little English.
He did, yes.
And so he could extend the invitation to this nice taxi driver that you wanted to invite this stranger whose language you didn't speak to dinner to celebrate your birthday.
Well, when you say it that way, it does sound a little crazy. But I've always loved humans, and I just felt so grateful to have made it there in one piece that I just needed to offer that to somebody, some of that goodness, some of that grace and sweetness. And so it turned out that the first person I caught eye contact with was a taxi driver. Of course, he thought he was coming back to pick me up to take me somewhere else. And then fortunately, the concierge invited him in and explained that I wanted to have dinner with a friend. And would he be that friend? Yeah.
So you then, after this trip to this island off China, you say in your book about travel being the compass back to self. And so you do some more traveling. You go to Vietnam. And this is where you create your own silent retreat there in Vietnam. And you practice meditation. You didn't speak. You didn't talk to anybody for a week. That was what you decided to do. And at the end of this silent retreat, you begin to realize that your meditation, because you're getting up in the night and meditating on a regular schedule, you had a routine. But then you begin to realize that meditation could be all day long.
Yeah, so what's happening for me at that time in my life is I'm beginning to realize that the quiet and the peace and the contentment really is inside. And although I can't hold on to it, and although I can't figure out how to make it apply to my entire experience, I have all of this angst still about my sexuality because I haven't resolved. God has not specifically told me it's okay to be gay, essentially. And without that, I didn't know what to do. And so I go to Vietnam and I find a place and I decide I'm just going to be quiet, literally not talk for 7 days. And that's the experience that we talk about. And that leads to what I call, or what they call, mindful meditation. And that's the practice where it's not just when you're sitting in a disciplined way, but it's all throughout the day where you're being mindful.
You're walking when you're cooking
all
the time during your day. Well, you have a lot of lessons in your book that we could take to heart. And listeners might like to know, because now you are the CEO of these philanthropic foundations, and your trip takes you through from Vietnam to Guatemala. But when you come back, you find happiness mm-hmm. with a wonderful woman named Melinda. And the two of you now have a son,
we
Huxley
do.
True. So there's a happy ending to this story that people, I think, will enjoy your book on so many levels.
Thank
Alexa.
You.
Alexa Benson-Valavanis, her book is Sipping Tea with Buddha and Christ. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, kcho.org. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.